by showing you a few pictures.
Cell biology and physiology are more conducive to that, or are more in need of that, than molecular biology. And then we'll turn back the lights and use chalk. So what you have here is an immunofluorescent picture of cells. And that's exactly what we're going to do today. We're going to talk about how you get this picture and what it represents. We mentioned last time the idea that the cell has a cytoskeleton. And these are parts of the cytoskeleton here. And this is the nuclei. So these cells have been treated to show three different things. Now, here you have three different examples. Instead of the same cells treated to show all three, you have samples treated three different ways. Because remember, there are three parts to the cytoskeleton: intermediate filaments, microtubules, and microfilaments. And these, I don't think this is the, I think these are actually pictures of the same cell from the patterns on the right. And you see that the three fibers are not arranged in exactly the same pattern, nor are they oriented in the same way. Now, I had one other pretty picture just for the fun of it. This one is very similar to the second one, but I just had two nice ones. And then I have one more picture that I wanted to show you. I didn't put this up in front because it's not so pretty. But this is an electron micrograph of membranes. And remember we said last time that every membrane in the electron microscope appears to have three layers. And you can see here this is three separate membranes, each of which has three layers. Now, we're not going to talk about this today, but next time we will talk about membranes, their structure, and function. Now, I forgot that you have to turn the lights on first, but maybe I can do it with this. Yeah. Okay. Now, what were those pictures and how did they get them? I said those are examples of immunofluorescence. So I'm going to explain the two parts of that, the immuno part and the fluorescent part. And for that, you need one of the handouts for today, which is labeled 1B. Excuse me. The one from today, 2B. I apologize. No, I take it all back. It's 2C. I haven't updated my notes properly. So you need handout 2C. I have an old one with notes for myself, and I forgot to change the numbers. Okay, so handout 2C. We're going to explain the immuno part first. Now, you all know that you have an immune system, and as a result, you make antibodies, which are proteins, in response to foreign substances. Now, at the end of the course, we're going to talk about the biological function of antibodies. But today, and through the rest of the course, we're going to talk about antibodies as a useful diagnostic or laboratory tool. So what does an antibody look like? If you look at your handout, you notice we have a picture, a very crude picture, that looks sort of like this. Now, this is to illustrate that every antibody has a specific part with a specific shape that binds to a specific target. So this is the so-called variable part, and it contributes to the specificity. But in any given organism, all the antibodies of the same class have the same constant part. What they stick to is different, but their back end is the same. Now, what on the other hand, if you had antibodies from a different organism? So underneath, we have two that look like this. Now, all three of these, with the V-shaped variable part, would stick to the same target, the same foreign substance. But all three of these have a different back end because they would come from, say, different species. Say this would be a human one, this would be to fit our example from a rabbit, and this from a goat. So if we had another one from a goat, what would it look like? If we had another antibody from a goat, which part would be the same, the top or the bottom? The bottom would be the same, but the top would vary from antibody to antibody. So all goat antibodies have this on one end, and all rabbit of antibodies of the same class have this on the end. Now we have one more picture there to illustrate an important feature of antibodies, which is they don't really have one variable or grabber part. They have two. So a more accurate representation of this antibody would be to draw it more like this. While this antibody, we would draw more like this. Now, the significance of this is that because an antibody has two identical grabbers, which are both specific for the same thing, it can link two far copies of the foreign substance. It can grab one with this side, and link them together. And that's the significance of the fact that the antibody is what people call bivalent. It has two grabbers. Now, this is the antibody. Which is often just abbreviated AB. But what about the foreign substance that is grabbed by the antibody? That is called an antigen. Now, there are sample antigens on your handout. For example, these. These are very simple antigens. But many macromolecules and cells really are quite complicated and look more like this. Now, what this means is this is one spot that could be grabbed by an antibody. This is a different shaped spot that could be grabbed by an antibody. So this antigen is not treated as a whole thing. Each little piece of it will be grabbed by a different antibody with a different grabber. And the little piece that an antibody sticks to is called an epitope or an antigenic determinant. Now, I have one other example here of an antigen, which I drew like this. This would be, say, a protein that has two identical subunits, and so it has two grabbable parts. But unlike our big one here, both of them are the same. All of these possibilities exist. Now, why is anybody interested in using antibodies as a laboratory tool for detection? Suppose you have a protein and you want to know where it is. How would you find that out? If the protein has an enzymatic activity, you can find where it is by assaying for the enzyme. You can detect the enzyme by its enzymatic activity. But suppose the protein has no enzymatic activity. It's just a structural protein. How do you know where it is? Well, you add antibody to a piece of that protein. And that will allow you to detect the protein because each antibody is specific for one piece or epitope, and therefore each antibody binds only to one protein or very closely related ones. So it's more or less one antibody, one antigen. Antibodies are specific for their antigen. If it binds the antibody, it's the protein you're looking for. How are you going to detect that the antibody stuck to the antigen? Well, one way to do it is actually diagrammed on your handout on the top in the corner. You notice that this antigen that we drew here has multiple epitopes. And the one on your handout has multiple copies of the same epitope. Like in this picture, if I drew it right, these two triangle-shaped protrusions would be the same. Let's say these two bumps would be the same. Now that means, does not only the antibody have two grabbers, but the antigen often has two grabbable spots. It is also bivalent. So what? Well, if the antibody can grab two antigens, and the antigen can be grabbed on each side, the whole thing will make one big fat clump. And that's the picture on the side of your handout. You see that you have one molecule of antigen like this, and one molecule of antibody. So as we said before, one molecule of antigen can link two molecules of antibody. But then another molecule of the same antibody can trap another molecule or cell with the same epitope. In other words, the two of them all group together into a clump, and that's drawn out where it says antibody-antigen complex. And that only works because the antibody has two grabbers and the antigen has two grabbables, two grabbable epitopes. And if that's true, it'll form a clump. And one classic way of detecting an antibody-antigen reaction is by detecting a clump. This is the basis of classic blood typing, that you take type B blood cells and antibody to B stuff. Type B blood cells, as you may remember, have B-type sugar on their surface. If you add antibody to B, it will clump. Remember, they have many copies of the sugar on the cell. And then the antibody links all these cells, and you form clumps that are so large you can see them with the naked eye. But if I add anti-A antibody, what will happen? Nothing. Because an A cell looks, say, like this. An anti-A antibody looks like this. So anti-A will clump A's, anti-B will clump B's, but neither will clump the other. Will they clump? What will clump an AB cell? Both. What will clump an O cell? Neither. Because neither the A grabbable nor the B grabbable is present. So that's how you do classic blood typing. You mix the cells with each antibody and see if it forms visible big clumps. Now, if you're looking in a cell for a specific protein, you don't really want clumps. What you want to do is add your antibody and have it stick to wherever your antigen is. And then you want to know, where is my antibody? So in order to do that, that's where the fluorescence part comes in. The antibody has to have some sort of tag on this end so you can find it. In other words, you don't want an antibody that looks like this. You want an antibody that has something detectable attached to the end. It could be something radioactive. It could be an enzyme you can assay. But the most common thing is a fluorescent dye. And that's why we call this immunofluorescence. And that's what you were looking at in those pictures. Now, what is the big deal about fluorescence? Something that is fluorescent, as we know, emits colored light. But the trick is, in order to emit light, it has to be irradiated. But something that is fluorescent, when you shine light of one wavelength on it, it emits light of a different wavelength. And so, using the proper combination of filters, you shine light on the thing and see what it gives off, and you don't confuse what you shine with what you get. So using special microscopes, it is very easy to see where your fluorescent tag is. Or as people say, where the cell lights up. Where is the fluorescent material going, boink, boink, boink? You can find out. So how does this work? You look where it says there are really two variants on immunofluorescence, which are called direct and indirect, and both are diagrammed on your handout. Now, what's the idea with direct? It's sort of what we've been talking about. Somewhere in the cell, you have the protein, the complicated protein you want to detect. You add antibody, and the antibody has a fluorescent dye attached to it. Now, how do you get antibody? You take your foreign material or antigen and you inject it into an animal, a rabbit, a horse, you can do a person too, but for lab work you don't. You put it into an animal, and then the animal makes antibody, which is specific for that antigen. How it does that, we will discuss later. And those antibodies are found in the blood. So you take blood from the animal and you isolate the antibody to the antigen. So if this is what your antigen looked like, some of your antibodies will look like this. And you take purified antibody and you add the fluorescent dye to the end of it chemically. So now you have a tube full of antibody containing fluorescent tag. And you add your fluorescent antibody to the cells. Now, what if there's an area of the pro-cell that looks like this? Your antibody will not stick. So you add your antibody, let it stick where it will, and then wash off unattached antibody. And now you detect the bound antibody by its fluorescence. And that's called direct immunofluorescence. So as it shows in your picture, this is the antigen, this is the antibody, and this is the tag. Now, if you wanted to detect a different protein, you could do the process all over again. But there is another variant on this. This is direct immunofluorescence. The second picture tells you about indirect immunofluorescence. What's that? The trick here is that the primary antibody to you use has no tag on it. So you see, you start again. You start with your antigen. And now you add antibody. This is called the primary antibody. You got it by getting an animal, immunizing an animal. But it has no tag on it. So how are you going to find it? Well, this was made in some organism. Let's say a rabbit. Be sure our pictures match. Yeah, this would be a rabbit. So this is rabbit antibody. The primary antibody was made in a rabbit. Well, now you have a second antibody, but this antibody is directed to the back end of rabbit. Basically, you take this antibody and treat it like an antigen and stick it into a goat. And the goat will make antibody, and some of that antibody will be directed against the constant part. So this is goat anti-rabbit. And you do this in a way such that most of your so-called secondary antibody is not directed against the variable part, but against the constant part. This secondary antibody has a tag on it. It is fluorescent. Now, why on earth would you do this mess? Why bother with two antibodies when you could get away with one? Well, first of all, you can get more, as they say, signal, more fluorescence this way, because one molecule of antibody will stick here and another molecule of goat will stick here. So you get twice as much fluorescence. You actually get even more because of the way this is done. What we're saying is that multiple molecules of secondary antibodies stick to the first, and so you have a lot more fluorescence emitting from here. But the real reason for doing it is another one, or I would say an equally important, if not more, reason. In your picture, we have antibody number 3. And I put it over here, which is maybe not the best place, but I meant this variable part to be different from this variable part, but I drew the picture in a hurry and it may not be different enough. So we really want this to be quite different in antibody 3 than it was in antibody 2. So this is antibody number 3, just for, it wouldn't be the third one, this is just for reference purposes. How are we going to detect where antibody 3 is? It's not labeled, right? Has no tag. Can we use the same secondary antibody to locate antibody 3 that we used for number 1? I want you to discuss this for a minute with the person next to you. Can we detect antibody 3 with the same secondary antibody that we used for number 1? But I want to ask you to be honest and not look around too much. How many people think you cannot use the same antibody? How many people think you can? How many people are not sure? Nobody will confess, huh? Well, most people seem to think you can use the same one. So rather than, I won't embarrass anybody by asking them why not, let's see why do we think the same one will work. We took the secondary antibody here. And what did it stick to? It stuck to the back end of number 1. Is the back end of number 2 different? No, it's exactly the same. The back end of this one, the back end of that one are the same. Now what this means is we can make antibodies to many different proteins. None of them have to be labeled, but it's all have to be made in a rabbit. And then we can find them using the same labeled secondary antibody. Now, what this means is I don't have to, each time I make a new antibody, I do not have to tag it with fluorescence. That's difficult and expensive. If I want to identify a new protein, say this one, I want to find where it is in the cell. So I inject this into an animal, into a rabbit, and I get rabbit antibody. Can I use the same secondary antibody? Yes, the same labeled antibody will find this, or this, or this. Which protein I target depends on the primary antibody, but finding it depends on the secondary antibody, and I can just keep using the same one. Okay. So, yeah. Does this mean that the antibodies of one species have a common tag? Yes. There's a kind of complication, but all human antibodies of the same class, and what that means we'll explain later, but all of them have the same back end. So they don't have, this isn't a tag, it's the same recognizable epitope in the language of immunology. Yes, in the back.
If you have reaction to basically the epitope of another antibody, won't it light up all over instead of just the specific antibody you're looking for?
Her question is, why doesn't this bind to everything lying around? And the answer is, the way you've done this, usually you use one primary antibody at a time. Some of those pictures they didn't, but generally you use one primary antibody at a time, and then you do it again with a different primary antibody. And you can use the same labeled, tagged secondary. Another question? Yeah.
When you're marking the secondary antibody, how do you make sure that it's only the secondary antibodies that you're marking?
How are you sure that you're only adding label to the secondary tag? Remember, you have a test tube full of secondary antibody that you got from, say, a goat. Didn't come from a rabbit. The primary antibody came from rabbit blood, and the secondary antibody came from goat. So they're in two different test tubes, and you only add fluorescent dye to one test tube and not to the other. Okay. So now, having said all of this, how do you use it? Was there a question back there? You just stretching? No. Okay. So, people argued for a long time whether cells really had a cytoskeleton or not. Because when you look at a cell in the electron micrograph, you couldn't see anything. If you treated cells to basically remove all their organelles, there seemed to be something there. But people said, by the time you beat up the cell and took all that stuff out, what you got left looks sort of stringy. Well, big surprise. It's an artifact. So people wanted to get antibody to the components of the cytoskeleton. The problem is, they didn't know if there was a cytoskeleton. They didn't have purified cytoskeleton to stick into an animal and get antibody. What they did, though, they did it another way. It has been known for a long time that certain cells have specialized structures that contain the equivalent, well, they contain the proteins tubulin and actin. So now if you look at this time, again, I'm going to get it right, you want to look at 2A. No, 2B. 2B. Where it says important features of the cytoskeleton, you want to look at the bottom. You see where it says permanent structures? It turns out that many cells have what are called cilia or flagella. Depending on how big they are, exactly what they do, they have different names. But these are protrusions from the cell that move. And it's known that they move largely because of a protein called tubulin. So people were able to take cilia and flagella, break them up, isolate tubulin, and make antibodies to tubulin. Similarly, in muscle, there are things called thick and thin filaments. They slide past each other, which is what allows muscle to move. And the thin filaments are made of a protein called actin. So people were able to isolate thin filaments from muscle, isolate actin, and make antibodies to actin. Now, people thought that actin was found only in thin filaments, and tubulin probably only in cilia and flagella. They suspected that the spindle fibers were made of one of these, but during interphase, they thought cells would not have either actin or tubulin. But just in case, they took fluorescent antibody to these two, one at a time, and added them to living interphase cells. They injected fluorescent antibody into living cells. And that's how they got the pictures that you just saw. Antibodies to tubulin light up one set of fibers, which are now called microtubules, because that's written actually over here. Well, spindle fibers and are made of microtubules. And actin is what, I know I want to say this another way, but let's say that microtubules are made out of tubulin. Microfilaments are made out of actin. Now, let me backtrack a minute in terms of this table and say that P people knew that in special conditions there were fibers, microtubules or microfilaments in cells. But they didn't think they were there all the time. They were known to be there, though, during mitosis, because it was known that the spindle fibers were actually microtubules made of tubulin. And actin is involved in forming the cleavage furrow. So if you look at your table, you can see that these are labeled as temporary, also called dynamic structures. They were known to form during mitosis, but they were thought not to be around the rest of the time. But that's wrong. It turns out that the tubulin that makes up the spindle fibers is there all the time during interphase, but rearranged in a different way. In cilia and flagella, it's locked into a permanent structure that stays there all the time. But in ordinary cells, the tubulin takes different shapes at different times. Now, what's this cleavage furrow business? After you move the chromosomes to the two ends of a cell, after the chromosomes are separated at anaphase, you remember that in telophase, you start pinching the cell in half, and you have to divide the cell, not just the chromosomes. And you pinch the cell. And that's actually done by actin. Actin forms a ring around the cell, much like a string around a balloon or a rubber band. And it's the actin that causes this furrowing or pinching off. Okay. But the point of this is that those actin subunits during interphase aren't just lying around waiting, they are assembled into fibers even during interphase. And that's, again, what those pictures were. So antibodies were made from known structures, and they detected the existence during interphase of microtubules and microfilaments. Now, if you look at the top of your handout, it tells you a brief overview, which we want to do, and then we'll go and look at each of these classes in detail. Microfilaments and microtubules were discovered first, and it was only later that people discovered there was a third kind of fiber of intermediate size, and that's why they're called intermediate filaments. Now, those three are on the top of your handout. And virtually all eukaryotic cells have a cytoskeleton made of microfilament and microtubules during interphase. However, only the cells of multicellular organisms have intermediate filaments. And that's one of the reasons they were discovered later. They're not found in single-celled organisms. Now, this handout on the top summarizes some of the things that we said last time, but just to remind you, it has, for example, the size in nanometers, which is the diameter of the filaments. And as you can see, microtubules are the biggest. Now, why are they called tubules? Because it shows you the shape here, the shape of the protein, the shape of the tubule is hollow. So a microtubule is hollow, but a microfilament and an intermediate filament are solid. And that's probably clearer if you look at the picture on the other side. That on the top left, you see a microtubule. And the point is that a microtubule is made of balls. Now, the reason we draw it that way is a tubule is a complicated structure, but it's made of individual molecules of tubulin. And each molecule of tubulin is globular. So all these globs get it together and form a tubule. Now, this is a microtubule. Now, as you can see from the picture of the microfilament, the individual molecule of actin is also a glob. but they form into chains, two chains of globs twisted around each other. Intermediate filaments are different in that the unit, the protein that is polymerized to make the fiber, is itself a fiber. Instead of being round and globular, it's longer and skinnier. So in the intermediate filaments, and there are several pictures here of intermediate filaments, the only part that matters is the very bottom. Intermediate filaments are like cables with multiple strands. And the individual molecule is a short strand. And we'll do models of all three of these in a little bit. Let me just say briefly that there are two kinds of tubulin called alpha and beta, which differ slightly. But it's the same everywhere. Actin, this little unit of actin is called G-actin for globular. And G-actin is virtually the same in all living things. And also tubulin is very similar in all living things. Intermediate filaments, though, are not always the same. There are multiple kinds of intermediate filaments. They all have certain features in common, but they vary a lot from cell type to cell type. And we'll come back to that. All right. So for reference, we have this table. And I want to go back now and talk more in detail about what are these things. Intermediate filaments, microfilaments, etc. Okay, before we go any further, there's just one more thing that I want to mention. We said that microfilaments and microtubules are found virtually everywhere, but not intermediate filaments. There's another big difference. Microfilaments and microtubules are associated with movement. They are involved in the movement of cells. But intermediate filaments are not. Intermediate filaments are thought to be largely support structures. Now, microtubules and microfilaments can serve that function also, but in addition, they are capable of movement for reasons we will explain. So we're going to start with microfilaments, because in a way they're a little easier to understand. We said that the individual unit of a microfilament is a molecule of actin, a globular round molecule. So it would be something like this. Now remember, this is a whole protein chain, but it's folded up into a glob. It's not stretched out, it's folded up into a glob. And a whole bunch of these stick together. And then, and for this, it's a good idea to look at the picture on A. The two chains twist around each other. So a microfilament looks like this, except I did it. They have to have both ends going the same way. A microfilament looks like this. Now, one of the important things about this is that each individual chain and each microfilament has a head end and a tail end. Now remember in DNA, the two chains were anti-parallel, so if you turned it over, it didn't matter. Notice these two chains are parallel, so that there is a plus end, so to speak, and a minus end. Now, microfilaments have, therefore, polarity, and so do microtubules. They have a head and a tail. Microfilaments do not. This is thought to be intermediate filaments don't. Microfilaments do, microtubules do, intermediate filaments do not. This is thought to be related to movement. If you're going to move relative to this thing, you have to know one end from the other. If both ends are identical, it's, huh, which way do I go? So this thing has a unique polarity or direction, and it's much clearer if you look at a real picture that each of these is actually asymmetric. And they tend to grow preferentially at one end. And that end is known arbitrarily as the plus end. It has nothing to do with electric charge. But they grow preferentially from the end that's called plus by adding subunits and growing. They both preferentially add and preferentially lose from the same end. Now, as you might expect, growth involves energy. In this case, it involves ultimately ATP, but we're going to ignore the details. Now, the question of how these grow and how it's regulated is not a dead issue. It is something which is currently of very great interest and under intense scrutiny, because the movement of eukaryotic cells is often caused by extensions or shortenings of actin. And the latest issue of Science, in fact, has an article about proteins that help in the growth of these, regulate the growth of these fibers. Now, the individual piece, one peptide chain, is called G-actin for globular. But the microfilament, when actin is like this, it's called F-actin for fibrous. It's the same protein, but arranged in a different way. Now, there are many drugs that interfere with actin polymerization. For actin, and it turns out also for tubulin and microtubules, the cell has a supply of monomers. And at any one time, they are assembling into polymers, or depending on what the cell is doing, the polymers are getting shorter and falling apart into monomers. And there's a dynamic equilibrium. Usually in one part of the cell they're growing, one part they're getting shorter, in some parts it's balanced. Now, many drugs bind to one or the other and stabilize or sequester that part. Now, this is what simple drugs do. Now, the idea is, if a drug binds to monomers and puts them out of commission, what will happen? You reduce the supply of available monomers, and you're going to push the equilibrium that way. On the other hand, what if the drug binds to polymers and stabilizes them so they can't fall apart anymore? That will also disrupt this equilibrium because it reduces the supply of fall apartable polymers. And so essentially it will pull the equilibrium in the other direction. And many, but not all drugs act in this way. Many drugs, either directly or in other ways, act to either push this equilibrium to the right or to push this to the left. Now, one drug that binds to the polymer and stabilizes it and shifts it this way is phalloidin. This is why you should be careful about one of these. I think this is derived from mushrooms, and you have to be careful. The latriculin, it's actually latroniculin, shifts it this way. Now, there are other drugs listed in your table that have the same effect, but not quite in the same way. Cytochoesin works a little differently, but it has the same effect of driving the equilibrium toward monomers. Now, one of the ways that people visualize microtubules and microfilaments is using immunofluorescence. But another way they do it is they take drugs that bind to monomers or polymers and they add a fluorescent dye to the drug. And then they let the drug bind to the actin or the tubulin. Now, suppose you want to look at microfilaments and you can have phalloidin labeled with fluorescent dye, or you can have latrunculin labeled with fluorescent dye. You have your choice. And you want to light up or see microfilaments. Which of these is a better dye to use, a dye-coupled compound to use to label your microfilaments. Is one of these better, or will either one do the trick? What do you think? So try thinking about this. Talk about this one for a minute, and then we'll see what people think. You want to see microfilaments? Trunculin. How many people would use phylloidin? How many people are not sure which one? Okay, we have a few brave souls. Most people think you would use phylloidin. Why would you use phylloidin? You get, what'd you say? It stabilizes the polymers. Both of these stick to actin. But this one is going to stabilize monomers, and it's going to cause everything to fall apart. And all you're going to have is little pieces of G-actin. But phylloidin is going to stick to the polymer and lock it in place. And in fact, those pictures that you saw at the beginning, the red dye was actually phylloidin linked to a fluorescent dye, not an antibody. So phylloidin is often used to stain, that is, dye-coupled phylloidin, is used to stain microfilaments in lieu of or in addition to antibodies. Now, that's all I wanted to say for now about microfilaments, and now I want to talk about microtubules. So let me ask first if there are questions about the microfilament business before we go on. Now, we didn't explain the part about movement, but we'll come to that. Now, what's with microtubules? Microtubules are also made by taking globular proteins, putting them together, and making something bigger. And if you look back at your picture again, on A, it sort of shows you what's going on. Remember we said there's two kinds of tubulin, alpha and beta. They're very similar. And they join together to form a chain, where they alternate. Then what happens is the chains come together to form a tube. It takes a certain number of them, usually 13, to come together to form a tube. Once you form a tube, notice the tube again is going to have a polarity. It's going to have one end different from the other. One end grows preferentially, which is again conventionally known as the plus end. Once you have made a tubule, it grows by adding individual molecules of tubulin around like this so that it grows. You have to have these filaments first to form the first tubule piece, and then it just grows and shortens primarily at one end. Now, we think that microtubules usually are anchored in the cell. And the place that they're anchored at is called a microtubule organizing center, or an MTOC. And when you have an MTOC, the fibers, the microtubules grow away from it. So this is the plus end that's growing, and if it's going to shorten, shortening. And this is where the center is. Now, in most cells, there is a microtubule organizing center near the nucleus. And this particular kind is called a centrosome. They are also found at the base of cilia and flagella, but we're not going to talk about the details of this. If you take cell biology or you read Becker, you'll find out all about it. And the assembly or growth of microtubules also requires energy, but it's usually in the form of GTP, not ATP. We won't go into how it works, but of course it doesn't happen all by itself. Something has to power it. Now, again, as with microfilaments, with microtubules, there is also an equilibrium between monomers and polymers, and there are drugs that push the equilibrium toward the monomer and drugs that push it toward the polymer. And if you look at the table, two of the most famous ones are listed, that colchicine depolymerizes and Taxol stabilizes. Now, both of these, so Taxol shifts things this way and colchicine this way. Now, which of these drugs can be used to mess up mitosis? Turns out the answer is both. If you freeze the microtubules in place, the chromosomes can't move. If you make the spindle fibers fall apart, the chromosomes can't move. So both of these can be used to block mitosis. Now, colchicine has a medical use in the treatment of gout, but it's not clear that it has anything to do with its mitotic effects. It seems to be helpful for other reasons. Taxol is used in treating cancer because cancer cells divide more often than ordinary cells do. And so if you mess up mitosis, you preferentially mess up the cancer cells. With both of these drugs, the problem is messing up the target cells without messing up everything else, which doesn't always work very well. So both of these can have toxic side effects. Now, both of these microtubules and microfilaments, I said, were involved in movement. That is, both of them involve a fiber, either a tubule or a solid fiber, which has two clear ends which are distinguishable. And so something can move relative to the fiber. In order to have movement, you have to have a partner which uses the energy of ATP or GTP to move relative to the microtubulin or the tubulin or the actin, the microtubule or the microfilament. And that protein which allows movement relative to the fiber and which actually uses the energy is called a motor molecule. We want to talk a little bit about the most famous motor molecules and how they work. Now, these are listed again, if you go back to that table. You will notice that in the next to most right column, it says motor molecules. And it also mentions polarity. For microtubules, there are two well-known motor molecules or classes of them, which are called dynein and kinesin. While for microfilaments or actin, it's myosin. Now, actin and myosin are found, of course, in muscle in an organized way, and it's the sliding of the two past each other that causes muscle contraction. But myosin and actin also slide past each other to make the cleavage furrow to divide the cell and to do other kinds of movement. Now, dynein and kinesin move relative to microtubules. These two classes of motor molecules actually work in a different way. Dynein and kinesin basically walk along microtubules one foot over the other. In your notes, there is a link to a famous animation called The Inner Life of the Cell, in which there is a beautiful picture of there's both kinesin and dynein carrying something going along a tubule. It's quite, you may not recognize most of the other things at this point in that animation, but you'll recognize that. Now, dynein and tenesin have the different property that one of them moves toward the plus end and one moves toward the minus end. And that's marked here. The dynein goes from the plus to the minus end, and tenesin almost always the reverse. Now, what we mean by that is, remember, the plus end is out here. So dynein carries things from the outside of the cell. It draws them in toward the center. Kinesin, on the other hand, takes things toward the plus. So it goes, quote unquote, toward the corners. And that's the mnemonic for remembering which is which. Now, how do these work? As we've said, dynein, kinesin seem to work by having, they have two parts that go sort of foot over foot. So this is not a bad model for dynein or kinesin. And it actually, if this is a microtubule, it actually moves more or less like this, using, of course, ATP or GTP. But the trick is that the molecule, the motor molecule, is connected to something else. So it can be connected to another fiber. Now, if it is, as it moves down, the two fibers are going, assuming that the rotation takes care of itself, the two fibers are going to slide relative to each other. In anaphase, we know that the cell, the chromosomes move, and the spindle fibers slide out. They both are thought perhaps to lengthen, but they also slide relative to each other while by this mechanism. Now, in addition to moving fibers, and by the way, dynein is involved, and I think dynein, in the movement of cilia and flagella, and what's thought to happen there is that the second fiber is fastened down. And so when you move, you bend the fiber. You bend one fiber relative to the other, and that's what makes the flagella and the cilia move. Again, we're not going to go into the details, but that's the basic idea. Now, one of the most interesting things about dynein and kinesin is they don't just move one fiber relative to another. They allow vesicles to move from one part of a cell to another. Remember we said last time we drew a cell and had a lot of vesicles? We only had one vesicle in our cell. But we said that the parts of the endomembrane system are connected, and that a vesicle can butt off one organelle and move to another or to the plasma membrane. A lot of that is thought to occur by vesicles being carried along microtubules by dynein or kinesin. And so the difference is that instead of carrying a fiber, the motor molecule is attached to a vesicle. And so when it moves, it just carries the vesicle down the fiber. Now, this is extremely striking in certain cells. Nerve cells are very long and skinny. The body of the nerve cell with the nucleus then has a very long, thin protrusion to an end. This is called an axon. And at this point, the end connects to the next cell. There's a small gap in here, which involves chemical communication. But the signal goes like so. And in order for signaling to occur properly, special proteins have to be here at this very end of this connection is called a synapse. And they have to be special proteins carried from the cell body all the way down the axon to the synapse. And these axons are filled with microtubules. And it seems pretty clear we have seen motor molecules carrying vesicles in both directions. Now, which would be which? Kinesin goes to the corners, to the ends, so kinesin carries things down, and dynein is thought to carry things back. And this, there are a couple of things I should say about speed, that a molecule could get from one end to the other by diffusion, but diffusion is much slower than the traveling of a vesicle. On the other hand, what about nerve impulses? Nerve impulses are much, much faster. So in terms of speed, a nerve impulse is much faster than carrying a vesicle, which is much faster than diffusion. And it's important to realize that these axons can be very long. Most of the axons in your central nervous system are short, but some of the ones in your peripheral nervous systems are very long. There's one that goes from here down to your big toe. And you can see that carrying proteins from one end to the other of that is a major production, and diffusion would never do it. On the other hand, a vesicle wouldn't be nearly enough to tell you how to move your toe fast enough. Now, all of this is about how dynein and kinesin move things relative to microtubules. How does myosin move things relative to microfilaments? Myosin seems to have a different mechanism. It doesn't have 2 feet. It only has one, so to speak. And it works more in a ratchet sort of mechanism, in that what it does is it bends and attaches, and then it straightens up. And it bends and attaches, and then it straightens up. And it bends and attaches and straightens up. So it's a different mechanism, but still you have two things moving relative to each other. And when we get to muscle, we'll explain the process in more detail. Now I want to move on now and talk about intermediate filaments. So let me ask before I do that if there are questions about this part. Yeah.
What happens to
the question is, how does the kinesin that goes out to here get back, presumably with dynein, and how does the dynein that goes in get back out, presumably with kinesin? But that's an interesting question. I don't think anybody really knows the answer. People have tried all kinds of experiments using drugs that block one or the other in mutants to try and figure out how this works, and I think they're still working on it. Yeah?
Along the axon, I was under the impression that there's an electrical impulse that goes along the axon.
There is an electrical impulse that goes along the axon, and that's what carries the nerve impulse, and that is completely separate from the vesicle traveling down.
But the vesicle also travels and doesn't stay in the axon till at the end.
Does the vesicle stay over here? It does not. But
I thought it was...
The axon hillock is here.
Okay.
The vesicles, there's multiple kinds of vesicles here. And one kind of a vesicle contains neurotransmitter, and it stays down here. It releases the neurotransmitter and then gets filled up again. But what about the proteins that make up the membranes of the vesicles, and what about the proteins that synthesize the neurotransmitters? All of those have to be made here. And then those have to be carried down here in order to enable these vesicles to do their thing. So we have several different classes of vesicles. Okay. Now, as we said, intermediate filaments were discovered last, and they're thought to serve largely a functional, a structural function. They're not involved in movement. Now, how is it possible for a filament or a not to have polarity? Well, this is a quote-unquote macromolecule. These are actually Zacs, which is a slightly different toy. And you can make a very long chain of these, but you notice there is no head and no tail. I can just turn it over. It's the same thing. Every connection is the same. There is no head and there is no tail. This is a polymer without polarity. And that's what an intermediate filament is like in that respect. But I have a better model for what an intermediate filament looks like. Now, you want to match what I'm going to show you to your picture. On 2A on the bottom, there are two different representations from two different books of what an intermediate filament looks like. Now, both of them say that you have a single peptide. The one from Wolf shows the single peptide. The other one on the left from Becker does not. You have a single peptide chain. Now, notice, unlike with tubulin and actin, this single peptide chain is extended. It is not globular. Now, two of these peptide chains come together in the same orientation. Their amino ends are at the same end. Their carboxyl ends are at the same end. And that's what's shown in the second picture from Wolf and the top picture from Becker. So you see a dimer, which consists of two intertwined chains. And this seems to be, you might say, the basic unit. Two of these dimers then come together in opposite orientations to make a tetramer. And it's drawn two different ways on your handout, but it's the same basic idea. Two twisted chains come together to make four. Now, I have here my little model. So the idea is that this is a dimer. So this is two chains, both facing the same way. This is another two. So this is like two fingers, this is like two fingers. This is two and two, and they come together. Now you notice this doesn't have any polarity, it doesn't matter which way I do it. Because they're in opposite directions, it doesn't have any. Now what you do now is you take a whole bunch of these tetramers and align them. And when you do that, you get either the yellow band or the green band or the red band or the blue band. They just colored to make it easier to see. So this is two dimers, a tetramer, another one, another one, another one. And this is another series of tetramers, and they just stick together. And then these tetramers, this is, and one of these is usually called a protofilament. The books don't all agree in their terminology, but usually this thing with tetramers is called a protofilament. Now, everybody agrees that what an intermediate filament is it's a bunch of protofilaments twisted into a cable. But as far as I can tell, people are not absolutely sure of the structure of that cable. And if you look at the two bottom pictures, you notice they draw two different cables. One has them more or less lined up like this, except that it's solid. They're not flat this way. They're bunched. And the other one has them woven. It's not clear. But you have a cable, and you can see that a cable would have great strength because it has multiple strands all together. And these are used to strengthen the cells and help keep their shape. Now, in many cells, these structures appear to be stable, that they are there all the time. Now, like any other protein, probably pieces are lost and replaced, but they seem to be stable. But in some cells, they in fact come apart and come back together again. Just like with the spindle fibers. The microtubules that make up the spindle fibers completely rearrange at mitosis. It's the same old tubulin, but during interphase, it makes up the cytoskeleton. It anchors organelles, it holds the cell in shape. When it's time to do mitosis, remember, the cell rounds up. Those spindle fibers come apart into tubulin. The microtubules come apart into tubulins, and then the tubulins rearrange into a different set of polymers that make up the spindle fibers. Now, there's one set of intermediate filaments that does something very similar. Almost all of the cytoskeleton is in the cytoplasm. The microtubules and the microfilaments are completely in the cytoplasm. But there are multiple kinds of intermediate filaments, and one kind is in the nucleus. And those are called lamins. Now, if you look again at 2A, you can see that there are at least five kinds of intermediate filaments, which are shown here lined up next to each other, which have slightly different properties and are found in different types of cells. The four top kinds are cell-specific. Certain cell types in their cytoplasm have type 1, other cells have type 2, other cells have type 3, other cells have type 4. But the type 5 intermediate filaments, or lamins, are found in the nucleus. And they're the same. There's more than one of them, but they're all the same in all cells. So they're nuclear. They're found underneath the nuclear envelope. You remember that we drew the cell, and then we said there's this sort of two layers of envelope, of membrane around it. So the lamins are in here. As you will see, it's thought that there is some kind of fiber underneath just about every membrane. There's a special web under here. There's a special web under here. Probably under each membrane, to keep it in the right shape, there is some kind of web or fiber. And the lamins are found here in the nucleus, supporting the nucleus inside, supporting the nuclear envelope. And all the rest of the so-called cytoskeleton is indeed cytoplasmic. Now, it's important to remind you that it is a great misfortune of cell biology that there is a different kind of protein called laminin, which is part of the extracellular matrix. So these are outside the cell. And I don't know what Nudnik called them, such similar things, but that's what they both are involved in layers, I guess, and that's why. Okay. Now, all the other intermediate filaments are found in the cytoplasm. And they are, as we've mentioned, tissue-specific. Now, the genes for all these different lamins are the same in every cell. All these, I've misspoken again. I mean of all these intermediate filaments and all these lamins. All of the genes, of course, in every cell type are the same, with the exception of the immunoglobulin-producing genes, cells. So the point is that nerve cells and muscle cells have the same genes, but they read out and transcribe different ones and make different proteins. And exactly how they do this is one of the big questions, which Dr. Heiklin will be talking about. Now, different cell types transcribe different intermediate filament genes and make different proteins. And one of the reasons that this turns out to be important is that when cancers occur, they are cells that grow without proper regulation. And the real danger is when the cells spread. When the cell metastasizes, instead of just making a lump, cells break off and go to another part of the body and start making lumps there. That's when you have real problems. Now, knowing what to do about the cancer cells is often helped if you know what kind are they. Where did they come from? Were they originally breast tissue? Were they originally stomach tissue? Where did they come from? And they often look the same. But the kind of intermediate filament they have tells you where they came from. And so that fact is used a great deal in therapy, in typing tumors and figuring out what to do about them. Now, I want to say a little bit about the evolutionary origin of the intermediate filaments, because remember that origin is one of our big five issues. And it turns out that the intermediate filament genes and proteins are a classic example of a gene or protein family. When you think about the proteins that exist in a cell, you think they're all different kinds of proteins. They're the enzymes of glycolysis, they're the enzymes of electron transport, there's a myoglobin for storing protein, oxygen, there's hemoglobin in red blood cells, there's all these different kinds of proteins. Well, when you look at these proteins, they aren't all equally different from each other. What happens is that proteins fall into families just like animals do. Just as like there's cats and there's dogs, and the cats are really not just house cats, but lions and tigers, and all those are similar. So it is that proteins fall into families. All the globins are similar to each other. All the immunoproteins are similar to each other. And it turns out all the intermediate filaments are similar to each other. And we now think that the way this happens has to do with the origin of the genes that code for these proteins. That what happens is that you have, say, one gene or several, and it codes for an intermediate filament, and that intermediate filament, or globin, or whatever, does something useful. And then, as a result of mistakes in either DNA replication, or crossing over, or meiosis, mitosis, you end up with a cell that has two copies of the gene. As long as there was only one copy, you couldn't tolerate big changes. Because if there's a big change and the protein doesn't do what it was supposed to, you're in big trouble. But now you have two copies. And as long as one copy continues to carry out your old function, you're okay. Now what's going to happen over time is you're going to get mutations in different places in the two copies. If these mutations make function worse, then they will be lost. The cells that carry them won't leave a lot of offspring, and the mutations won't be passed on. But if these mutations, in fact, help either improve the old function, or they allow the new copy to have a different function, then those organisms will flourish, leave a lot of descendants, and these copies will be passed on. Now, what I've just described is that mutation occurs. But what is really important here is selection. If you look at your picture again, you see that the five classes of intermediate filaments, or their respect, these are the proteins, not the genes, but they match up. You notice that all five of them are written like this. It's quite customary when comparing proteins to draw the proteins like this, always with the amino end on the left and the carboxyl on the right, and then to specify the areas of the protein or domains that carry out a particular function or have a particular structure. In this example, the part to the left of the dotted line varies a lot, but this part is always helical, and then you have a linker, and then you have helical, and linker, helical, linker, helical, and then this part varies. So this is a helical domain, linker domain, helical, linker domain, linker. Now you notice that all five are very similar in this part. If mutation occurs randomly, why are they completely different? This duplication has accidentally happened many times. There are at least five copies. And yet all five copies retain this basic structure. Well, the answer is that if the gene changes enough so that the protein can't act as a filament, that cell doesn't flourish, and that variation is lost. This is called conservative selection. There is selection against changes that ruin function. And as a result, certain sections stay the same of the gene and the protein over millions and millions of years. Because if you change something critical, it's doomsday. On the other hand, they aren't all exactly the same. So how do they get to be different at all? That's because certain mutations made the protein from here work a little different than the protein from here, and the cell that had both variants was better off than the cell that had only one kind. And so there is innovative selection for what works better. So the bottom line here is, it isn't true that there were no mutations in the gene for this part of the protein. It's just that any time a mutation occurred that messed up this part of the protein, that mutation was a dead end, and that organism didn't pass it on. Now, we will meet many, many gene families as we go, and many protein families, and next time we're going to talk about membranes and membrane proteins and transport across membranes.